live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. Is this the beginning of peace? The beginning of the end of the crisis that swept into all of our lives? This morning, about 2 hours short of the time that US President Donald Trump had threatened that a whole civilization would die, quote unquote, there's a deal. I'm Mary Guerin, this is The Conversation Hour, and we're going to take a moment to absorb the biggest global story that's still developing as we speak. Tell me how you're feeling with this news. Did you just exhale? Not knowing that you'd been holding your breath. Will this last? It's going to be a packed show. Don't worry, it's not all about this, but it is worth pausing and digging into what it all means. So it's a 2-week ceasefire. Iran is insisting it's not the end of the war. It still depends on the talks that are starting in a couple of days. As we're hearing in the news, the missile alerts in the region are still going off, but Iran has agreed to open up the Strait of Hormuz under Iranian military management. Whatever that means. So with 2 weeks of fuel movement, we've just heard this morning that really with no particularly ongoing resolution to the war, it won't be enough to have the oil producers in the region ramping up production. So that immediate relief at the Bowser for you and me, that's not quite on the cards. But Federal Energy Minister Chris Bowen is speaking this morning. In about 10 minutes, it's scheduled to start. We're going to keep an ear on that for any news or updates from the federal government to see whether this 2-week ceasefire, what that might mean for us. But tell me how you're feeling with the news. Will this last? I will be digging into this. Let's see what we know, what we still don't know about whether or not this is the real deal, the beginning of peace. And as I say, it's still a packed hour. If you have kept up any of those habits that we were forced into during those days of water restrictions and the drought, I want to hear from you. We've been hearing that our water storages in Melbourne and Geelong have dropped by the largest margin since the drought. And we've heard also that they're revving up the Wonthaggi desalination plant. We're going to be talking to someone who says that's not the answer, at least not the entire answer. We also do know that a report late last year said that Melbourne and the major regional centres could be placed on water restrictions by the end of this year. Now, I know it sounds like it's more doom and gloom, but we've been there, people. We know what to do. We're resilient. Maybe they'll come easy for you because maybe you've kept the habits from the water restrictions of the, what was it, late 90s? Early 2000s, 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Brag to me about what you have kept up. I know that I still can't get rid of the water after rinsing the veggies. I have to put them on the plants. Now, I'm not saying I'm virtuous. I don't think I'm that virtuous. It was just ingrained in me by those water restrictions. I did take the bucket out of the shower, though. So you tell me, you be more virtuous. You tell me what you have kept up. In fact, Kate has already texted in saying, I still have a bucket in the shower and the kitchen sink, use for the garden and amounts to about 60 litres a week. Good on you, Kate. And you even measure it as well. Well done. You tell me, have you had to explain to your kids what a drought means? I keep saying to my kids, you don't understand. How would restrictions work for them? How would they work in your home? I'd love to hear from you. Also, get ready to hit that line for your allergy questions. There's being more money poured into allergy research because experts are saying that allergies touch almost every Australian family, school and healthcare service. Maybe you've discovered allergies later in life. We're going to have an expert on who can talk about allergy management. And also, to top it off, another reason to brag. Tell me how many minutes a week you exercise. I'll tell you, apparently there's a golden number. There's even more reasons to move your body and to get into that exercise. That's all coming up. But first, is this really peace? We will get to if it's really peace. First, let's get to the water situation because, as we have heard, the state government has ordered 150 gigalitres of drinking water from the Wonthaggi desalination plant. Is that actually enough? Joining me now is Tim Fletcher, a professor of urban ecohydrology at the University of Melbourne. Thanks for joining me, Tim.
Hi, Mary. Good to be with you.
So let's zoom out and talk about the situation we're facing. Apparently, the biggest drop in water storages in Melbourne and Geelong over this past year than we've seen for quite a while, since the drought, in fact. How dire is this?
I don't think I'd use dire, but certainly we're at a point where supply has really been reduced. This last year really has been very, very dry, so inflows have been greatly reduced, and at the same time, demand keeps growing because overall population keeps growing. And as we've heard a lot about, there are quite a few industrial uses of water, such as data centres, but not only. So cities are always, in a way, running out of water. The history of cities is they always run out of water, so we're always looking for new sources of water. But, yeah, I don't think we're at a point where we need to be panicked, but we're definitely at a point where we need to be thinking about what's the medium and long-term future look like.
So before we move on to the solutions, you're saying that this is about increase in demand, and I do want to ask about those data centres as well. What about climate change? Is this inevitable that we are going to be having these water shortages, no matter what the mitigation is, at least that climate change will be very much pushing us in that direction?
Yeah, definitely. So I think the most certain impact is that sort of the increasing demand over time, which, as I say, every city around the world experiences and always has. Definitely climate is driving us to a less secure water supply situation. We have quite a different pattern of rainfall, so less often and more intense when it happens is the general description. And it sort of disproportionately affects our forests, where we get most of our water from, because they're getting a little bit warmer, just small amounts per year, but that increases the amount of transpiration or evapotranspiration, so the amount the trees suck up and throw back into the atmosphere. And they get the water before we do, of course, because it falls on them. And so generally those catchments over time are getting less reliable. They produce great quality water, but they're getting less reliable. And so government is right to start looking for other solutions as they become less reliable. They'll still always be an important source of water, but they won't be quite as reliable as they were.
You're listening to Tim Fletcher, who's a professor of urban eco-hydrology at the University of Melbourne. We're talking about water restrictions. What has stuck with you since the millennium drought? Before we get on, as I say, to what else government should be doing, apart from the desalination plant rev up that we've been hearing about in recent days, Tim Fletcher, what do you believe the prediction from last year that we could be looking at water restrictions in Melbourne and the major regional centres by the end of this year, 2026, that will become a reality? Is that more likely than not?
I find it difficult to predict the weather 7 days out, so I'm very nervous about predicting it a year out. But certainly that would be possible if we had really difficult dry conditions, right through the year. I think the government is quite rightly taking this step now to order this water. And remember, this is how the desal contract was set up, essentially, that they would forecast what they're going to need and then put in an order for the year. So it makes perfect sense that they've done this, and they've done it now so that they're well prepared for the rest of this year.
But you're saying that alone is not enough?
I'm saying in the long term, so I think it solves this year's problem. But in the long term, we really want to be making decisions well before the panic stage, because when we make when we are running out of water, we have to make decisions that we can deliver quickly, and that tends to limit us to things like a desalination plant, because we can let a tender and build that plant straight away. That's not necessarily the cheapest option for the Victorian community, and it's not really the most sustainable. If you think about it, we have more stormwater runoff, so rain that falls on our impervious, our roads and our roofs, etc., in Melbourne than our total demand. So there's that water.
What? Can you just repeat that? So more rain is falling into our gutters and so forth than we even use. Need. Wow. Yeah,
we use, we harvest only a very small proportion of that. And similarly, we recycle very little of our wastewater. So combined, that wastewater and that stormwater are a huge resource, and they grow as our demand grows. As you add more houses, you add more stormwater and you add more wastewater. And so I think my argument to government is we need to plan well ahead so we can put in place those type of measures, so harvesting of stormwater.
What would that look like?
Wastewater, so we're not having to implement in a panic another desalination plant, which is relatively very expensive and not that sustainable.
Do keep the calls and texts coming. I can see them coming in. Are you still, like me, using water-saving measures from the 90s? Retro is good sometimes, 1300 222 774. But Tim Fletcher, what would harnessing that storm water better look like? What would be required?
Yeah, so I think a classic illustration of it, and indeed there's been discussions of doing this in some of the new development areas of Melbourne, is right from scratch. When you build those areas, you run all of that water through gutters into its pipes and then into full treatment systems and then into storages. And then you make that that water available as part of the water supply. And that means every time you add, you know, a new hectare of development, you're adding a new water supply. So it means that you're basically adding capacity every time you add demand, and so it keeps up with itself, and that way you don't get into that situation. The technology is already well and truly proven.
Is it expensive?
No, it's less expensive than desalination. I think what stops governments doing it is that the governance is a bit more complicated. A desal plant, you can just let a tender and give it to one contractor and they build it and that's done, whereas if you do stormwater harvesting, you have to work with the water authorities and the councils and the private developers. So it's a bit more complicated. But in the end, it's going to provide this ongoing water supply. It's going to reduce the risk of flooding, which is another really important water topic to discuss. It reduces the amount of erosion of our waterways, which the state spends millions of dollars on fixing. So for the Victorian community, it's actually a much better value solution, a much cheaper solution, and solves three problems at once rather than just one.
Tim Fletcher, that just sounds like such a sensible idea that the cynical side of me thinks, of course, no one's acted on it. But is there any political will behind this? Are you gaining any traction behind closed doors as you spout your total common sense here?
Yeah, look, I think there's a fair bit of interest. So there are some... there are some proposals around for some of the growth areas in Melbourne that are being investigated, and a lot of the engineering work has been done. So we're definitely seeing a fair bit of interest. And there are some small examples that are done really well. Around the world, there are also some really great examples where it's being done. As I say, I think the uncertainty is just that governance, because you need to involve more stakeholders, and that's complex for governments. Mm. But from an engineering point of view, it's all very, very well known, particularly now where we have a lot of the smart technologies that allow you to manage these things with real-time monitoring and control. They can all run very efficiently. It's definitely possible. We just have to make that step to say, yeah, let's take the time to work with all those involved to actually do it.
Gary on text also did ask about how expensive it is, and his comment is that repiping the whole city is crazy expensive. I guess you're talking about concentrating on new builds, but when we do have state government and other housing experts who do want more density within our inner urban areas, is that a practical solution to sort of retrofit those areas?
Gary makes a really good point. So definitely the lowest hanging fruit is the new development areas. But if we think about, for example, all the activity centres where we're going to be rebuilding everything anyway, and there you don't necessarily even need to do a whole lot of piping. So let's imagine we build a 12-storey apartment complex. We put what we call a smart tank in the basement that supplies water for toilets, for laundry, for outdoor use, etc. But we still provide drinking water for all the more what we call intimate uses, so drinking and showering, that sort of thing. So that involves almost no piping other than separate piping in the building, but nothing above that. And that's actually relatively cheap. And importantly, that has a major impact on reducing flooding in some of the known flood areas around Melbourne, because you essentially can operate those things in a smart way so that before it rains, the system sees the rain coming in 3 days and it slowly trickles some water out of the tank to create room to receive that new water. So again, we've provided a water supply that might reduce the potable, the drinking water demand by 30% or 40%. So we're not flushing drinking water anymore, we're using stormwater.
And solving
flooding as well,
and solving a heap of problems downstream, if you'll pardon my terrible pun. Tim Fletcher, thank you so much for joining the conversation. Really interesting.
No problems, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Tim Fletcher, Professor of Urban Ecohydrology at the University of Melbourne, and you've been really leaning into this on the text line as well and on the calls. You are telling me what water restrictions, if we are going to be facing them, we're all resilient because you have kept up some water restrictions from the late 90s or early 2000s. And in fact, Saskia on text says, I'm 26. I spent a large amount of my childhood in the country, and to this day I have horrific guilt if my showers are over 2 minutes. My partner finds it ridiculous. He's from Chile. They have lots of water. Tony in Footscray, what do you do?
Hi, Mary. A couple of things. When I have a shower, I just put my head under the shower briefly, and then I put shampoo and body gel on. And so I turn the shower off for about 2 or 3 minutes. I douse myself with the shampoo and the body gel and then turn it back on, which means the sum total of water I'm using is about a minute.
Wow. On top of that, don't you get cold, Tony?
No, not really. Look, I'm prepared to have a little bit of pain just in order for water to be conserved.
Yeah.
So, no, not at all.
Good on you, Tony. You are a water warrior. Thank you. I will get to more of your calls. I do want to tell you that we are keeping an eye on whether Chris Bowen has been speaking. He's the Minister for Energy, of course, in the wake of the 2-week ceasefire, what that means for us at the Bowser as well. We will get to that very soon. Carol, you're in Mentone. What did you want to say?
I've kept up all the habits from the drought. So I bought a special thing that looks like a flat watering can that you lie down in the shower until the water warms up, and then you can tip it on the garden. And I have 3 water tanks, and I put a jug in the kitchen sink and the laundry sink, and I keep showers to a minimum. So I've just got in those habits and I can't break them anyway.
It's true, isn't it? There's just something in the back. If you've been through the water restrictions of the late 90s, you just can't break it.
No. So I would recommend that people keep it up all the time because water costs money.
Because water costs money apart from anything else, and it costs the earth. Thank you, Carol. Sarah, you're in South Bank. How are you going with water in your house? Hello, Sarah.
Oh, yeah, no, we're fine. But, hi, when my youngest son, he was born in 2000, so he knew nothing but drought. And when he was about 2 or 3, he ran in one day and he said, there are these awful black worms in the back garden. And we ran out. We thought, what is it? And my husband had turned on the watering system. He'd never seen a watering system before. And the black
worms
came up out of the ground. This poor kid is like, oh, this is a drought, baby.
So he's 26 now, and do you reckon he's still drought conscious, yeah. Sarah?
Yeah, I think he's pretty good with water.
Yeah, he would be. Good on you. All those worms, I remember it well, digging up the trenches and putting those in. Keep those calls coming on your water-saving measures. I want to get back to your calls and texts as well. We'll get to those throughout this hour. But it is 25 minutes past 11, and I want to dig into the biggest story in the world at the moment. Let's try and make some sense of it. Is this, in fact, peace? This morning we went from a civilized civilization about to be annihilated, to a double-sided ceasefire, quote-unquote, from President Trump. What does all this mean? Couldn't think of a better person to guide us through what it means than Roger Shanahan, a Middle East analyst, who joins me now. Hi, Roger.
Hi, how are you?
Short answer, hot take, is this lasting peace?
I think it's a bit early to call it that yet, but you know, a ceasefire is obviously preferable to what's been going on for the last 40 days or so.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you about the escalating rhetoric and what that, how we even absorb that, how we even assess that tactically and strategically and so forth. But let's look at what we do know about this ceasefire. We only know what's pretty much been put out on social media, a 10-point proposal from Iran that Donald Trump says is a workable basis on which to negotiate. Even just hours ago, I believed that the things that they were asking for, like reparations and so forth, were way too beyond the pale. What do you think is going on there in terms of the terms of this agreement?
Yeah, listen, it's with anything to do with President Trump, it's very difficult to determine what he's thinking at any one particular point in time. We saw, you know, 24 or 36 hours earlier that that 10-point plan was described as maximalist, and now it's described as being the basis for negotiations. Listen, there's a lot in there, and obviously the Iranians would not expect all of those points to be adhered to. Having it acknowledged as its basis for negotiations rather than, say, the US 15-point plan is, will and is being portrayed as a victory in Iran.
Mm. You're listening to Roger Shanahan. We're talking about this morning's ceasefire announcement between the US and Iran. Just on that, Israel has also said that it will have a ceasefire as well. What's your prediction or analysis of Israel's role in this ceasefire?
Well, listen, the reports out that Israel wasn't really privy to the negotiations or the decision-making process for the ceasefire, and they were more or less told that ceasefire was happening, they'd have to follow it. You can believe that if you wish, but it's in Israel's best interest to continue this. They're absorbing the damage that's been caused, but they believe the longer it goes, the more damage you're able to cause to Iran. So they're probably less enamored of the ceasefire than the US.
Mm. It's a good asterisk to put against all of it. Another part of the announcement from the US president is that, quote, we have already met and exceeded all military objectives, and we are very far along with a definitive agreement concerning long-term peace. Let's go to that first part. It's been a matter of some discussion that there's been no coherence, no clarity around the military objectives. What's your assessment of that claim?
Oh, listen, It's as with all things Trumpian, it's really difficult to understand his thought processes, and that was evident in the way that this military operation was announced. It was unclear exactly what the strategic objectives were. You don't separate political and strategic ones from military ones. There is a set of objectives. Military objectives are in support of the strategic aim. So simply saying we met our military objectives, of course you're going to do it because you have overwhelming firepower. So they more or less destroyed the Iranian Navy, which is not particularly large or powerful Navy. They destroyed the antiquated Iranian Air Force. So these are pretty straightforward military objectives. The problem is it wasn't tied to a coherent strategic objective. So, yes, you achieve your military objectives, but nobody actually knows what your strategic objective was from the start because you weren't able to enunciate it.
I guess then it's an easier claim to make, I guess. Roger Shanahan is Middle East analyst, and he's helping us absorb what happened this morning, if we can make it out. My ears pricked up, Roger, when I heard that it was going to be 2 weeks. It's become an almost signature time frame for Donald Trump. He's used that when he's talked about tariff deals, that'd be done done in 2 weeks, when he's managing expectations about any of the war, the Ukraine war. I think it was the mediators in Pakistan who came up with this idea of the 2 weeks. But let's just say that the 2 weeks is real and it wasn't just to play into Donald Trump's mindset. How practical is it? Is that a good time frame? Is it the sort of time frame that will work in these circumstances?
Listen, 2 weeks is a long time to try and nut out the details that you're going to have to enunciate if you're going to have any kind of lasting peace rather than just a ceasefire. But and they've also spoken about the ability to extend the ceasefire. So 2 weeks is just a period of time that's been selected. It could have been 3 weeks, could have been 10 days. So I don't think we need to put too much stock on it. It's the start point. And if they need to extend it, then they'll extend it.
The Strait of Hormuz, it will be reopened under Iranian military management, is the quote. What do you think that that is going to mean? And do you think that this eases the pressure on NATO and the rest of the world that's been under pressure from Donald Trump to act in that regard?
Yeah, listen, again, an interesting thing, one of the signature achievements of this ceasefire is that they're reopening the Strait of Hormuz, which was open for everybody before the military action was undertaken. So we're just going back to where we were 40 days ago. And there's an interesting part in the Iranian announcement that said it would be open to all traffic within Iranian military capabilities, or words to that effect. So there is language in there where, you know, Iran is more or less reserving the right to slow down it if it passage through the Strait of Hormuz, if it believes that negotiations aren't going the way they want it to go, and simply by saying, well, listen, we're not stopping and we just don't have the capability to approve everybody to go through. So again, the wording of these agreements is always very important. And I think in the Strait of Hormuz, it is open, but the Iranians believe they've got the capability to slow it down if as a pressure tactic for future negotiations.
And what exactly this means, if anything, for our petrol bowsers. We will keep across what the Federal Energy Minister, Chris Bowen, has been speaking about. We're going to pick out the pertinent points for people. So stick around for that. But before I let you go, Roger Shanahan, I do want to talk about the increasing rhetoric. We are consumers now, quite, I guess, experienced consumers of Donald Trump's language and manner. But it has ramped up to a level, very sweary, very capital letters, over the past few days. When you have gone to that extreme in your rhetoric, what have you got left tactically or strategically? What do you make of that rhetoric in a time of war?
Yeah, listen, there's probably a couple of things there. First of all, it's pretty obvious that the Iranians stared President Trump down. They were willing, their brinksmanship was greater than his brinksmanship, and they probably understood that his increasing rhetoric was a sign of increasing frustration, and so they were less likely to give in, but yet still offer something on the table, more on their terms than on his terms. I think a secondary and very real aspect of this is this war really showed how isolated the Trump administration is from its allies. You can't have that kind of rhetoric during wartime, let alone the kind of abuse he hurls around to his country's closest allies, and then expect them to come and help in a war of choice. So it demeans the office of the president. It doesn't do anything for his nation's standing in the world. And at the end of the day, it doesn't have a practical effect, because countries will understand from this that if you want to stare him down, you can stare him down.
We've still got a few more years of this to go, Roger.
Two and a half, to be precise.
Exactly. Thank you so much for joining the conversation today and really helping us just pick apart what we can and should make of it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That's Roger Shanahan, Middle East analyst. This on text, I suspect Trump sent his last crazy total destruction post when he knew the 2 week proposal was in hand in order to look like he forced it. He is worse than a child. He is a teenager. That from Gary. Yes, are we all becoming knowledgeable about Donald Trump's brain? Is anyone capable of understanding that or his tactics? It's a crazy morning. It's been a crazy world. And coming up next, though, let's go to something completely different. Maybe you've been diagnosed with an allergy later in life. Allergies are affecting so many of us, just about every family in Australia, we're told. More federal money is being poured into research. We will talk about allergies very, very soon, but as we've been saying, Chris Bowen has been speaking and he was asked about the Strait of Hormuz reopening and what that in fact means for all of us and for Australia rethinking policies around the fuel excise as well. This is what he said.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves. We welcome progress, but I don't think we can say the Straits of Hormuz are now open. There's more work to be done. We'll keep the work that we have been doing. It's good work. You know, the Prime Minister will go to Singapore and cement that work in. I'm on the phone to fuel companies every day. EFA is doing good work. That's appropriate. As I said, not a single ship that's been expected to arrive in Australia has not arrived. That doesn't mean, as I've said all the way through, that there isn't risks in the supply chain. Obviously, the sooner the Straits of Hormuz open, the better for everyone, the world, including us.
So that was Chris Bowen, the Federal Energy Minister, talking just over the past half hour or so. I think that could be summarised as managing expectations, not getting hopes up over the two-week ceasefire. There needs to be a much more permanent solution in the Strait of Hormuz. But he's saying, still do what you've been doing, try and save that fuel. Before we do get to allergies, we've also been talking about saving water as well. I've been asking you, what are those restrictions from the 90s that you learned, they were ingrained in you, you just haven't given them up? David in Doncaster, what do you think about the facing water restrictions? Will you be okay?
I'm ex-military, so we had a lot of water
conservation
in the water. yeah. Conservation when we're out in the field. But my idea is that because we've got all these rebates for solar panels on your roof, and you've got rebates for the wall heaters and the hot water systems, etc., why not have it so that there's a system that the rain off your roof is captured in a water tank, and then it's plumbed straight into your toilet, so that it just flushes the toilet. That's all you need, and it reduces the amount of water that gets wasted with the toilet system, and it's not going into the stormwater drains, and it's not causing flooding and everything else. So it has a twofold effect of saving the water.
Yeah. David, that just sounds so sensible. I don't know why. I can't answer that. Maybe a plumber who's listening can say why that wouldn't happen.
Well, it makes common sense.
It does.
You've got a resource that's just going out into the storm water drain, that if you utilise it, then it doesn't have to be treated. It doesn't have to be put through osmosis and all these other bits and pieces and chlorine. And you can have a bypass that if the tank does get below a level, that it does go back onto mains, but it means that you're saving water, and you're saving the water going into the stormwater that goes further downstream and causes flooding.
Exactly. And as we heard from Tim Fletcher from the University of Melbourne earlier this hour, the stormwater is actually the key. Apparently, if we get even a little bit more of it, we'll have everything that we need. Thank you, David. Phil has also called in from Wodonga. What do you think?
I saw a documentary quite a while ago where in Germany they had water tanks under the footpath with stormwater, and all the solar panels on top of the buildings that weren't being, no one else had put up, government-owned.
So the tanks are underground?
Yeah, and people were using for gardens, toilets, anything grey water or black water was all being used from the tanks.
Phil, if Germany has gotten on top of it, we should as well. Phil, thank you. That's really interesting as well. Thank you for everyone who's been calling, and if I've got more time, I'll get to more calls about the water restrictions that we have internalised since the millennium drought. But coming up next, let's talk allergies. We have heard that the federal government has put an extra $14 million or so into funding for national allergy research and public health programs, because 8.2 million Australians have allergies. And so this is really more people than we think. Every time you look around on the tram, you're probably looking at either someone with an allergy or someone who knows someone with an allergy. Dr. Adil Aziz is Deputy Chair of Victoria at the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners and joins me now. Hello, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
Do you see that sort of that many allergies? Is this as big a problem as those stats seem to suggest?
Yeah, allergies are very common. I have them myself. My family has them. I think they run a little bit more in certain families, but definitely they're very, very common and we see them all the time, correct?
Do they become more common later in life? Is there any correlation?
That's a great question. So allergies are one of these little unusual conditions, I would say. If I just may say what an allergy is. An allergy is basically the immune system overreacting to what we consider harmless substances, or we like to call them allergens. That can be pollen, that can be food, it can be pet dander, anything triggering things like sneezing, itching, hives, or breathing difficulties. So essentially, they can come on at any time in one's life, and they can disappear at any time in one's life. Sometimes they can come on in childhood and you can outgrow them. Sometimes they may not exist in childhood and they can come on in adolescent or later adulthood and they can disappear later, or you can stay on with them. So there's no one size fits all. There's no rule. And we see a myriad of different types of conditions that come on with allergies. It's very common.
So there's no one cause either, I guess. It's just totally random.
That's correct.
Apart from genetics, as you alluded to.
Yeah, correct. Depending what type of part of the body part you're talking about, it can be, you know, itchy eyes in, you know, hay fever season. We call that allergic conjunctivitis, runny nose, allergic rhinitis. Like asthma is a type of allergy, which is basically the same thing in the lungs, you know.
It is 17 minutes to 12. You are listening to Dr. Adil Aziz. We are talking allergies. 1300 222 774 is the number to call if you have questions about allergies. And I can see a couple of people on the line there. But just before we do get to those calls, Adil, what are the more common allergies that you do see?
As I mentioned earlier, hay fever is a big one. I have that one. We see pet dander as a common one. Dust allergies is a dust mite that eats dust, and that's very hard to find because you can't even see the insect. It's very, very small. It's not visible to the naked eye. Other things are, pretty much anything. Food allergies, you know, anything can cause an allergy to different types of people, essentially.
Sarah has called in from Beechworth. What did you want to say, Sarah?
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask about a later in life developed egg allergy. And it seems to have exacerbated my asthma and hay fever. And I just wondered if that was a common thing.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Sarah. Obviously, I'm going to preface all questions with speak to your own GP because they'll know more about you than myself. But I'm happy to give you some general opinions and advice. Yes, it is something that can happen. Anything we ingest can give us a systemic allergy through not just the gastrointestinal tract, which is basically our food tubes and intestines, but also on the skin, in the lungs and things like that. So if you're having an inflammation of different parts of the body, you can also have an inflammation in the lungs, and that would exacerbate your asthma, correct?
Do you find?
Okay. Yeah. And wheat seems to have done the same thing now as well. So, but wheat's a common one.
Wheat as well, did you say, Sarah?
Yes. Well, it's never loved me, but now it really doesn't love me. So our relationship's over.
Oh, no. And it's a delicious relationship until it isn't anymore.
Well, and it's in everything, as you find out when you try and exclude it from your diet. It is in everything, so it's a tricky one.
Oh, that's interesting, Sarah. Thank you for calling. Adil, is Sarah's experience common, that one thing can lead suddenly to a few things?
Yeah, so like I said earlier, like the egg is something that you're ingesting, so it's systemic, and then it goes through the bloodstream and it can exacerbate inflammation in different parts of the body. It is common. We do see it whether it comes on early in childhood or adolescent or later in adulthood. It just depends on the person. There's no exact rule. We don't know exactly why something happens later in one's life. but it's something that we definitely see and we know how to manage. And for Sarah, definitely to speak to your GP, we have lots of amazing methods to manage this problem.
It's 14 minutes to 12. We're talking about allergies. Jenny is asking, what role does the inclusion of unnecessary ingredients in our food play in allergy harm? Soy is a top 10 declared allergen, says Jenny, yet it seems every second commercial loaf of bread includes it as an ingredient to produce protein count. What do you think, Adil?
Yeah, I'm a bit of an old school doctor where, you know, I like just washing something and putting in your mouth. So whether that's fruit or veggies where you don't have to have any human involvement, I'd like to say. We know that that's what's best for our body. We do have to then, on the other hand, manage, you know, getting food to places that don't have the opportunity to just pick something up from the ground or from a plant or a tree and eat it straight away. So therefore comes in this whole, you know, argument of how do we make food last longer. Of course, none of us doctors want there to be preservatives in food and all these extra added ingredients. But there are, you know, food safety officers in place. There are, you know, different bodies that are in charge of these things above my pay grade. From a doctor's point of view, you know, less is more, I would say. So just the less ingredients something has, the better it is for you in general, I would say.
Mm. We're talking allergies because the federal government has tipped in an extra $15 million into research. Don't know what the baseline is for that research money on top of that, but it is welcome news, especially for Ali in Dandenong. She's texted in saying, my daughter is 14 and not growing out of her anaphylaxis to dairy, wheat and egg. It has shaped our life. She cannot safely eat out. We're packing for a short holiday tonight. We'll take chopping boards, frying pan and saucepan, knife, some food we can't always find when away. We book rooms with full kitchens every time. Allergies are life-changing and I welcome the new funding. That's from Ali. Adil, that really does underline what allergies, how serious allergies can be and how life-changing they are.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very sorry to hear that story, and unfortunately it's not it's very much the norm for some families, and I empathize with it and sympathize with it. I do also have, you know, lactose intolerances and all the rest of it, like a lot of families, and it is quite hard to live with. But then there's severity, right? You can have a mild intolerance, and then you can have, like in this person's case, a very severe allergy where they have to actually take their equipment with them when they travel, which can be quite cumbersome. She said, I remember her saying that was hoping to outgrow it, and there's no like rhyme or reason as to who outgrows it and who doesn't outgrow it. Doesn't sound like they're going to outgrow it, and from what I'm hearing,
how do you diagnose that? How common is it to outgrow an allergy, and when do you kind of assume that it's not going to happen?
There's no way to diagnose when someone's going to outgrow it or not. You can test for allergens. That's usually done by a GP referring to an allergist or an immunologist, where they can run some studies to see how severe an allergy is, on allergen is, which is basically the thing that causes the allergy. And we do have ways to, through an immunologist and allergist, basically to reduce how severe an allergy can be. And that can be referred through your GP, through an allergist or immunologist in severe cases. And this would be one of those cases. I would guess that would be good for them.
Mm. And before I let you go, I guess what we've been talking about is some of the most extreme circumstances and the extreme effects that allergies can have on a life. But is it hard to diagnose some allergies? Do some just sneak up on you? As a doctor, does it take a long time to actually figure out what is an allergic reaction?
Yeah, I think the biggest problem is when patients and sometimes parents are not sure what it is, or maybe they trivialize something that could be potentially something serious. We saw it when thunderstorm asthma happened. You know, that was a type of allergy that, you know, was subtle and didn't really present to many people. Lots of people who I saw back then, and even this last a week or two ago, I had a really bad patient by telemedicine who was struggling to breathe. They had no idea they had asthma, and I just had to, you know, explain to them that this is what you need to do and then get the right help. So yeah, it can sneak up on us, and it's really dangerous when it does. So if there's any symptom that you're not sure about, just speaking to your local GP is the next best step.
Absolutely. Adil Aziz, yes, you had that rider, but I'm sure that you are helping people who are listening as well. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you.
Adil Aziz, who is Deputy Faculty Chair of Victoria Victoria at the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. It's 9 minutes to 12. Deb from Surf Coast is saying, yes, why is soya added to everything? My grandson is allergic to it. My heart goes out to all of you and all the kids and all of the holiday makers who are having to go those extra yards because of allergies. Hopefully that research money makes a difference. But coming up next, I'm going to throw a pretty dramatic stat at you. It's going to suggest that midlife exercise could dramatically extend your life. What actually counts as enough? I want to hear from you. Maybe how many minutes of exercise you do a week. We're going to figure out if it's enough. So, as I promised, a dramatic stat. Just a few hours of exercise a week in your 40s, 50s, and 60s could halve your risk of early death. This is from a study, a long-term Australian research study. It was based on women. I'm going to be asking my next guest whether it holds true for men. And what is that magic number? Dr. Bin Nguyen is from the Prevention Research Collaboration within the University of Sydney's School of Public Health and joins me now. Hi, Bin.
Hi, how are you?
Good. This is a dramatic stat. Tell us, what did you find in terms of the magic number of exercise a week for women in particular, and we'll get to the gendered aspect of this, in their 40s, 50s and 60s?
Yes, it is a dramatic number indeed. I might just give a bit of context. Most previous studies that have examined physical activity and health have measured physical activity at one point in time. And so they don't really measure how physical activity levels can change over time. We all know this is true.
Yes.
Based on experience. So our study was unique in that it provided this long-term evidence in women of the effects of physical activity during mid-age on the risk of dying. And basically what we found, so we used data from more than 11,000 women enrolled in the Australian Longitudinal Study on Women's Health. And we had information collected about their physical activity levels every couple of years. So we actually had information about their activity levels over 15 years.
And
so what we, yes.
and with that, you figured out sort of an optimal number, did you?
Yes. So what we found was that women that consistently met the World Health Organization physical activity recommendations, so that is at least 150 minutes of moderate intensity activity per week, had half the risk of dying early compared to women that remained inactive throughout this period.
Half the risk of dying early.
Yes.
How do you define early?
Early is... not dying from, let's say, not too soon.
Okay.
maybe 10, 20 years too soon, you know.
Right, below a sort of an average age. Got you.
Yes.
So 150 minutes a week. What sort of exercise? Did it matter?
In our particular study, we didn't break it down by type of exercise. Mm-hmm. But, you know, any activity counts. This could be walking, cycling, swimming, even gardening, going up the stairs. So every little bit counts in the overall amount of activity someone does in a day.
So 2.5 hours a week. Just tell me, because you did base it on women's studies, do you have any capacity to extrapolate this for men as well?
So because this was based on women, I don't want to extrapolate it to men, but
sure.
Of course, physical activity is good for everybody of any age, of any sex. And there are studies that show that being active in midlife as well for men is important for their long-term health.
Yeah.
It might not be the same type of study, but there is evidence out there as well.
You talk about, you know, obviously those ages between 40 and 60 or 40s and 60s for women, for men as well. But there's a lot going on in our lives, isn't there? What do life stages and life changes at that part of your life, how does that impact people with their exercise?
Yeah, I agree. There's so many life stages in one's life that can impact how much activity you do. So for women in the midlife stage, they might be working, they might be caring for kids, caring for their parents as well. They're juggling a lot, and you know, they have to try to find a way to fit activity in around everything else they're doing. And it just serves us as a reminder that it's important to remain physically active, even if it's doing something that you enjoy once a week. You know, you got to start somewhere. And even that will have benefits, even if you can't do it every single day.
So that would be your top tip, is just start somewhere.
Yes, and then build from there if you can. Just to remind you, you know, like physical activity is important for your mind, your body, for social connection as well. So, yeah, find something you enjoy and get out there and reap the benefits, I'd say.
Top advice. Bin Yuen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That's Bin Yuen from the Prevention Research Collaboration within the University of Sydney School of Public Health, a really good reminder for all of us. Diane, you've called in from Bendigo. Was this music to your ears? Hello?
Yeah, I do 5 hours a week.
5 hours? Yeah. Good on you. What do you do?
I just walk an hour a day.
Oh, that's great. Do you combine it with anything? You know, you're going to the shops or...
I do some weights and, so I'm happy with that. And I'm 69.
69, you're already beating the odds and you're going to beat an early death according to the studies. Good on you, Diane.
Oh, thank you. I hope I live to a reasonable age.
Absolutely. With your enthusiasm, I'm sure this is going to happen. And we have been talking about water-saving measures. Sharon from Ballarat, you have a tip?
Yes. Over 15 years ago, I'm sure there's other people who have done this, my builder put us, we had to get a water tank because they just brought those rules in. And he said, well, I'm going to attach it to with a pump to your toilet. And so my toilet's been flushing ever since.
There we go.
The water tank.
That's what we were talking about. I think it was Dave who called in and talked about that. I did see that from texts, other people going, yeah, Mary, we've done this before. Good on you. You must be feeling pretty happy now that you've heard the news about the water restrictions potentially coming.
Oh, yeah.
Sharon, good on you. Thank you for calling and thanks for everyone who joined in that conversation today. Todd McKinney has joined me as well in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
What's on your afternoon menu?
Well, we're going to talk a few things. I'm looking for a new hobby. And
oh,
so
yeah.
I want to get some recommendations from, you know, the ABC listeners out there because I'm 60 looking for something to do. You know, it's really, it's
I'm
a weird...
the same. I don't really have a hobby.
No, I want to get the work-life balance thing going. So we're going to put that question out there. But we're also talking stings today. What is the most painful sting you've ever experienced? What have you experienced? Have you been
blue bottle? Blue bottle when I was young.
Well,
yeah,
and then,
it was terrible.
Of course, there's that remedy for blue bottles that you wee on it. Is that true?
I don't remember anyone doing it, so...
No. Well, no, they don't do it. You do it to yourself, I think.
Oh, okay, maybe that's the way.
We're going to unpack that anyway.
Todd McKinney with you in your afternoons. Thank you so much for joining me today. You can find this on the ABC Listen app as well. Talk tomorrow.